you know, discipline is what you have, like, when a goal is big enough, right? Like, when, you know, I've heard people talk about that, you know, when you need to achieve a certain goal as much as you need to breathe, like, as much as you need air, like, that's when, you know, you're going to have the discipline to do it. Because, yeah, discipline is doing something when you don't feel like doing it, and there is a reason for it.
Hey guys, check out the 2023 Street Cop Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, Gaylord Convention Center. It's going to be the event of the year. Keynote speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Medal of Honor recipient, Navy SEAL Jason Redmond, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Marine Corps Special Forces and Leadership Coach Cody Alford, Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff David Clark, and Sheriff Mark Lamb. It's going to be one hell of an event. And on top of that, we have all of our instructors and additional instructors from other companies going to be at the event, giving you everything they know for you to have a successful career and get the results you want to get in the field as a police officer. On top of attending the event, you'll get face-to-face time with every instructor attending the event, and all the keynote speakers will spend time with you. We got special events all week, giveaways, nightlife. It's going to be really, really worth your time, energy, and effort. I promise you, you will not regret it for a second. To register for the conference, check out streetcop.com, click conference, and everything you need will be there on the homepage. If you are looking for a room, just click book a room. The block has been sold out at the Gaylord Opryland Convention Center, but there are many hotels nearby within a walking distance of the event. You don't want to miss out on this opportunity. We will see you there.
111, 110. You trying to be a street cop?
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. Your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino. I'm with us today, and boy, I don't even know where to start with this whole history of who this man is, but I'll let him explain some of his history as a UFC fighter. I don't want to even say this wrong, because I know you did MMA, then BJJ, and then back to BJJ. It's a whole different thing, but let's face facts. He's a well-known guy in the space, but appreciate him being here. He's a kind of a New Jersey native. I think he's a Brazilian native to start with, but grew up in Jersey, right?
Yeah, so adopted New Jersey native in a way, you know. So I grew up in Brazil. I lived in Brazil until I was 20. Then I moved here when I was 20 years old, lived with Renzo Gracie, and I lived here in New Jersey for 25 years.
Oh, shit, you know?
So I'm like more New Jerseyan than Brazilian. I'm Jerzilian, you
know? Ricardo Almeida, everybody. So, dude, how did you decide to come here at 20? What was the decision there?
So the original school that I trained jiu-jitsu in Brazil, Renzo Gracie was there. You know, when I started training, Renzo was one of the only black belts. And he had moved here. He opened a school in New York. And he was opening a school in Philly. And he needed, like, an instructor. And I was actually born in New York because my parents attended they did their master's when I was born.
I moved back
to Brazil, you know, from 2 to, like, 20, I lived in Brazil. And then I came here, but, you know, having an opportunity to come and learn from Renzo and, you know, lived at his house and traveled with him to Japan and, you know, later, you know, all over the world fighting and competing. So,
dude, that's badass.
Yeah.
Wait, so, all right, let's go back. Your parents are from Brazil. They come to New York.
Yes.
To go to college.
Yeah.
It's a very common thing, right? Yes. I have friends from different countries of parents or people come and study. Did your parents speak English to you growing up or just Portuguese?
No, I think my first language was English. You know, they were doing their master's degree. And then, you know, when we moved to Brazil, I lost it, like, completely. But I think I always had the ear for it. And then, you know, just English lessons and stuff. And when I came here, but most of the English courses in Brazil are, like, British English.
Oh.
So you learn, like, all this, like, British nomenclature, you know, like trousers and things like that. And I don't know, if you go to Macy's, oh, I need to look at your trousers. People were, like, looking at me like, what is this guy talking about, you know? But yeah, I think that I always kept the English a little bit in the back of my mind.
So, dude, you grew up in Brazil. Tell me about that. Like, what's it like growing up in Brazil? And then how did you transition into, like, starting to train to fight?
I mean, I started training martial arts because, especially at the time, you know, if you go out, you're a young man growing up in Rio de Janeiro, you got to able to hold your own, you know? And yeah, Brazil is like the Wild West. It's like here probably like 100 years ago, if not more than that, you know, where there's a lot less, you know, they're same laws, but the laws are a lot less applicable. You know, like if you get in certain situations, you're going to have to handle them themselves.
Yeah.
You know, like, so there was a lot of fighting growing up. Sometimes you just couldn't get away from it. It was just a matter of just being safe. So my dad wanted me to train, and I started doing jiu-jitsu when I was like 15. And, you know, at 20, I moved here. I stayed with Hanzo Gracie. I never really wanted to do MMA. I was more into the, you know, teaching and practicing side of jiu-jitsu, you know. But I just, I guess my competitive nature, like I had an opportunity to, you know, to do an MMA fight actually in Japan back in the day. And I won that fight. I came back to the United States, and then like into Hanzo's gym walks Dana White and Lorenzo Fertitta at
no
the time.
Shit, dude.
They had just purchased the UFC.
What year was that?
2001.
Okay, I was going to say.
They had just purchased the UFC. Or maybe they purchased in 2000, but 2001 is when they walked in. And they wanted to get Hanzo to go fight in the UFC, but Hanzo had a contract with Pride in Japan at the time. So Hanzo's like, man, I have a contract. I can't, but I have these two kids over here. They could go and fight for you. They're really good. It was me and Metsera. So that's kind of like how I started
fucking
fighting
cool,
in the
dude.
UFC. Like 2 months later, I was fighting in the UFC.
That's fucking cool.
Yeah.
Before you were 15 and started fighting, like, were you in a lot of fights before that as a kid?
I mean, like, as a young man, especially if you have no training, right? Like, I think that, you know, if you think you could fight, you're stupid, but, you know, most of the times you don't think you can. So you maybe, like, run away from fights, right? Like, or you try to get away from bullies and things like that. But I think as soon as I started training, not that I looked for fights, but, you know, I just kind of had the confidence that, like, on a one-on-one situation, I could handle myself. So I think I'll probably get in less fights, so to speak. But, yeah, if it needed to happen, then for sure.
So, dude, you're 15, you're training in Brazil. And then you tell your parents, like, did they know you were going down the road of, like, being a fighter? Is that what it was looking like?
So they knew. I started competing right away. It was a very, like, competition-oriented school at the time. So I started competing right away. Like, I won a couple state tournaments. I won, like, the national championships as a junior. Then I won it as an adult for my belt level at the time. So they knew that I was very, like, deep into jiu-jitsu. But MMA just wasn't a thing, you know? Like, fighting just wasn't a thing. Like, I came here in 97. The first UFC was in 92. I was already training. When the 92 or 93, I was already training when the first UFC happened, but it wasn't something that we, you know, it was kind of like you need to be really good at jiu-jitsu to even do that. And I just never thought that I was good enough. But as the sport grew and I came here, I trained with Hanzo, I had this opportunity and I just kind of took it, you know.
When did you know you loved it, dude? Because you have to love something to be this good at it, right? So were you 15 and the first time you did it, you were like, oh shit, this is for me.
I think for jiu-jitsu, it's natural for us, like, human beings, you know, like, men and women to grapple, right? Like, if you see, like, siblings, they always grappling, like, pushing each other around and just kind of mingling. It's like a way to mingle, you know? And when I joined the academy, I think right away I came home and I'm trying all the moves on my little brother, or getting carpet burns, like, in the carpet, you know? But for me, like, jiu-jitsu gave me, like, a tribe. I think it was more so than just the practice itself, you know? Like, I feel... like, especially young men nowadays, you know, like, the dad's always working, right? Like, they're mostly with mom. And my parents worked a lot. So jiu-jitsu gave me, like, a little bit of a family of all these, like, crazy, like, dudes, right? Like, having, like, a crazy uncle, like, a tribe of, like, some of the toughest dudes I ever met. And, you know, you see these guys that will go party and they always get in trouble. And I'm like, I don't think I want to be like those dudes. And then you see the guys there, you know, you never hear from them getting in trouble. You never hear from them partying. And then they're killing everybody on the mats. I'm like, oh, I think I want to follow these guys. Right? I think I want to be more like them. And these guys over here, they're always coming in and getting tired in the middle of practice. So it gave me a little bit of, you know, a way to grow up, discerning from good and bad choices, or maybe choices that were a little bit more aligned with what I wanted to be, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. And when you came here, how was your English at 20?
Man, like I said, it was, you know, I was calling pants trousers and whatever the nomenclature
but you
from
could
British language,
though, right?
But I could communicate. Yeah, it wasn't that hard, you know? I mean, I would say that it was much harder being an immigrant or coming into the country with a heavy accent.
But you were never, you're actually a U.S. citizen, right?
Yeah,
you're born here.
Yeah, but as soon as I opened my mouth, people were like, wait, yo, where are you from? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, sure.
But back then, I think people didn't accept foreigners as much. And I think nowadays, you know what I mean? Like, we are... you know, we are the last stop of the world. Like, everybody wants to come to the United States.
Do you go back to Brazil often?
I try once a year. My parents are still there.
Do they come here ever?
They do. My dad was actually just visiting for a month.
Do they speak English?
They do.
That's cool, man. So how's your relationship with your parents?
My relationship with my parents is great. You know, like, I think they're separated, they're divorced, you know what I mean? Like, so I have like a different space and a different relationship with my dad and my mom. But, you know, even growing up into jiu-jitsu, my mom was, they're both really good athletes and competitive athletes. My mom in swimming, my dad in, you know, first karate, then he did like triathlon and, you know, surfing. My dad's a really good surfer. But when I fought, my dad would be like, oh, I can't watch this. You know, my son gets hurt and he'll go have a drink and try to sit in the corner and not watch it. My mom was like, no, I want to go. I want to watch. Like, I want to see this.
That's cool.
You know, like, I want to be a part of it. So it was kind of cool to see that. But they're always both very supportive of me. They were supportive of me coming here, you know. I think having their grandkids grow up in a foreign country, I think it was tough for them as grandparents and just, you know, watching me become an adult from far away. But I think when we get to our 18s and our 20s, you know, much like the kids do here, they go away to university. I kind of like, United States was my university in a way. New Jersey was my university.
Yeah. Well, dude, I mean, you came to a state where there's a big Brazilian culture here.
Yes, true.
You know, so, like, true. I mean, there are people who come here and obviously end up in Newark, right, where there's a big Brazilian. And almost never even speak English because they're surrounded by just Portuguese-speaking everybody. My friend's father was, he was born in Italy, but he came here when he was three. So I didn't notice until I was an adult when we were at his pizzeria. And I'm like, how old were you when you left Italy? He's like, I was three. I'm like, you grew up here? He's like, yeah. I'm like, how the fuck do you have such a heavy Italian accent? Well, because he grew up in Linden. He's like, and everybody spoke Italian. My grandmother told me when she grew up in New York, she didn't know people spoke English until she was 8 years old. She thought everybody spoke Italian in the United States. So it's very interesting, dude, like, and I see a lot of people will tell me, like a lot of friends of ours who do emigrate from other countries, and they're like, if you come here and hang out with people from where you're from, you'll never learn the culture here and you'll never learn English.
Yeah.
So you gotta find like English speaking friends
for sure.
And to get your language better. So you go into the UFC. Tell me about like your career, dude. Like tell me where it goes from there. You're 20, you're living with Renzo Gracie, which is fucking cool. What was that like? You know, like is it crazy?
Oh man, it was probably like one of the best experiences of my life, especially as a young man. You know, here I am with like a living legend, and he's just kind of like my older brother. You know, like I'm trying to soak up everything as far as jiu-jitsu, but like with any great man, like you start to observe, see how they treat people. You know, and Renzo, I don't know if you ever seen or met Renzo, but it's like, you know, it's this larger than life personality. But he'll literally take the shirt off his back, and you know, he'll make anyone that he just met feel like you've known him for your whole life. And yeah, for sure, you know, observing like someone be like that and at the same time one of the best fighters in the world, one of the best fighters in the Gracie family, was for sure the opportunity of a lifetime, you know.
That's cool.
I think it's a huge part of why MMA got so big here in this area, where we've had quite a few champions, so many guys there in the UFC come from New York, New Jersey area. I credit a lot of it to Renzo, you know?
No shit, dude. It's interesting. We have a lot of people here.
Yeah.
So tell me more about, like, now Dana White comes in, you get recruited to UFC. How'd that go?
Man, so, you know, at the time, to be honest, at the time, I didn't want to go fight in the UFC. All the biggest fights were happening in Japan at Pride FC. Then later, the UFC bought Pride. But at the time, the UFC wasn't even on pay-per-view, right? Like, we had, like, all these senators that, you know, were kind of fighting not to let the UFC be on pay-per-view. We just had this stigma of, I don't know, like, people didn't think it was real. You know, half the people didn't think it was real, and half of it was just, like, too violent, so people were, like, against it. Meanwhile, in Japan, you go to the fights and you know, you're into these like 20, 30, 40,000 people arena. They actually had one at the Olympic Stadium with 80,000 people at one point. And I'm like, man, do I want to fight in this league over here where nobody cares? It isn't even on pay-per-view. And even though they had great fighters at the time, if you wanted to be the best in the world, you were competing in Japan, right? And later on, many of those guys came, and actually a lot of the UFC guys were better than them. But I was like, Renzo, don't. I don't want to sign with these guys. I don't want to fight in the UFC. And he's like, well, Carter, I met these guys. You should go. These guys are going to make MMA the biggest sport in the world. Like, this is going to be the biggest league in the world. And I was like, man, what is he talking about? Like, how? They're not even on pay-per-view. Like, how are they going to even have money to do this, you know? And then Renzo just had the foresight. And again, you know, right place at the right time and having the right mentor or the right guide, you know, Renzo made me sign with the UFC, and, you know, I fought in the UFC for quite a few years. Then I went back and I fought in Japan, then came back and fought in the UFC. That's actually when I met Frankie Edgar. I was still fighting, and he came to be my student, you know. But for sure, that was a huge door that I didn't want to go through. That Henzo talked me into it.
It's interesting that Henzo had the insight to recognize a good opportunity.
Yes.
What did you learn from Henzo besides fighting, besides big brother, almost second father type of shit, but then business mind, business sense? Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of your business adventures, or I don't want to say business adventures, business ventures. Yeah.
So what we do, you know, in teaching a jiu-jitsu school, right? Like it's a service business, right? Like, so you're in a sense serving people, right? Like a lot of black belts think that people are there to serve them. Like, I'm the black belt, I'm this. And when, no, it's the other way around. Like, as black belts, like, we're there to guide people and to serve them. And from Henzo, I learned to treat everyone equal. Like, to, yeah, there is a typical, in any environment, there is a hierarchy that forms, like, pretty quickly, right? Depending on the type of business, on the type of culture. But the hierarchy in jiu-jitsu is a very performance-based. Who could beat who kind of gets a saying. And Henzo, it didn't matter how good you were, like, he would treat everyone the same, right? Like, you had, like, no favorites, in a way. Even though in his heart of hearts, I think that he did. I think that's the first thing I learned. And then the second thing I learned is to be very welcoming, you know, like, to people, especially what we do. A lot of times people come into the school, they're very scared, right? Like, to, you know, if they come into a martial arts school, they know they're probably, like, the least proficient in a room full of killers, right? Like, it's kind of like you're a little fish and you're walking into a shark tank. Like, you know that something bad's about to happen to you. And Henzo was always very welcoming. He always take the time to, you know, to shake hands, to hug, to smile, to talk, to get to know, like, a new person coming in, whether there was someone that was going to just come and stay or someone that was just visiting for a week, right? Like, so for me, coming from, you know, I think I'm probably more like an introvert, like, versus Henzo. You know, I learned and really quickly understood the importance of, you know, of being welcoming and creating a culture where everyone is able to help each other versus just sort of be like the old kind of, like, you know, we see, like, Cobra Kai, right? Like, if we see the Karate Kid, like, that type of mentality and that type of culture, for sure, jiu-jitsu is nothing like that.
What was it like transitioning into business, right? Starting to add that into your life of, like, now thinking about, I'm getting older, I'm going to start opening schools. What does your business portfolio look like a little bit? Like, how many, you have the school in Robbinsville, right?
So I have the school in Robbinsville. I've opened a few jiu-jitsu schools in the area. I had the school in PA, but I opened a few jiu-jitsu schools in the area with a team of couple of my students, which is Gracie Baja. There's one in Princeton, one in North Princeton, and one in Newtown, Pennsylvania. I opened a couple in Arizona, partner up with my brother. About 8 schools in Arizona we opened together. He's out there running them. Like, I go every once in a while. And I actually just opened a school in Florida. Like, my main school, main location, you know, like, I've been traveling back and forth between New Jersey and the Tampa area. So that's been super cool. You know, like, I like the people in Florida. Like, I like the, you know, not to get too deep into politics, but, you know, we got shut down during COVID up here, you know. So I like the ability to have a little bit more freedom and a little bit more business friendly environment down there. And it's basically just cool people from here that have moved down there, bit like me, you know. Almost like every one of our students have come from New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, you know, Indiana, Chicago, like all the frozen states, and, yeah, you know, trying to get a little bit of a breather. But that's been a super cool experience.
Are you living up here half the time and living down there half the time? How's that
half
working?
Half here, half there.
Where are your kids? Your kids down there?
My kids are going into university.
Oh, you got, yeah, your kids are that much older than?
Yeah,
oh,
they're
shit.
They're both running track in college, so, yeah.
Now you're obviously involved in business. How much is this taking your time now? It's nuts, right?
Yeah, so just to give you a perspective, like, you know, during COVID, like, I changed the business model a lot. Like, I took everything that happened in the administrative side and the office side of a martial arts schools, and I brought it to a virtual team. So we actually have a team of a couple of ladies that work with us. I have one lady that helps us with social media. She does all the social media design. She edits videos, and, you know, she does all that for, like, a couple of our schools. Then I have a like an OBM, which is an online business manager. She's basically a project manager for me and my wife, because we run both the schools together. My wife runs a legging company. She sells leggings online. e-commerce, and this lady just stays on top of us as well as the rest of the team. We have another lady who's a mom who works with us doing customer service, like student service. Someone needs to, you know, cancel a membership or freeze a membership, or they're trying to come in and take a class and they're scheduling an introductory class. She might confirm the appointment. She might, you know, cancel the appointment and help them come into the school. So, yeah, we built like a virtual team for the administrative side. And then the instructors that I provide most of the guidance to, like, are the ones like inside the academies, inside the schools.
How'd you meet your wife?
So everyone that I meet is through jiu-jitsu, right? Like, if you have nothing to do with jiu-jitsu, it's kind of like I'm here because I fought a little bit and I did some martial arts and maybe I taught like a couple cops and you know what I mean? Like, so everyone I meet is through jiu-jitsu. My wife was the same. She's from Colombia, and I was teaching a seminar in Florida at one of my good friend's school. He used to train in New York, one of Hanzo's guys. He moved down to Florida and he had a school there. And I used to travel, like every 2 months I'll go and teach a class at a school. So I was teaching a class and I kind of met my wife in class. We didn't really talk at the time. But then later on, we started talking through like social media and stuff. We went out on a date and yeah, we've been together for 11 years.
So your children are from a different woman?
Yeah, from my previous marriage.
Yes. Okay, yeah. So how'd you meet your previous wife?
My previous wife, so I had a friend, it's a long story, but I had a friend visiting from Switzerland. So I spent some time in Switzerland, like training and doing some of the stuff. So I had a friend from Switzerland visiting the United States, and he wanted to go out. And on the last day that he was going to go out, that he was going to go back to Switzerland, I took him out to, I think it was Queens at the time. It was a big Brazilian community. And then at a bar, I just met my ex-wife at a bar. But it was mostly just me hanging out with my good friend from Switzerland. He also runs a jiu-jitsu school there now. And yeah, just me taking him out as a goodbye for him returning back to Switzerland. He spent quite a long time here staying with me.
So then you have the two kids. Do your kids fight at all?
No, man. They are very serious into running. You know, they started running in high school. And, you know, the level of high school sports is crazy. You see, once your kids get into high school, they, at the same time that I teach classes, the times they will finish high school and then they will have practices, you know, they have running practices. And for running, you know, I think all the sports, man, the kids train Monday through Saturday, you know. So they started running. They started to get pretty good. My son is already in the university, running for the university that he's at. My daughter is actually going to go to the same school and also be on the running team. So once they got into high school, it was really hard for them to be at the academy because the running practices with the same time, you know. But sometimes in between seasons and stuff, they'll come in, they'll practice a little bit.
That's cool.
All growing up, they did martial arts, which I think it was instrumental for them becoming like good, like hardworking, coachable athletes later in high school.
You know,
I think for sure martial arts is a game changer for kids that don't start being like the most athletic, most developed kid, right? Because if you're athletic, you just stay out of your way and you're going to figure it out, right? But for the kid that needs that discipline and work ethic or sometimes focus, right? Just to be able to focus the attention and discipline and be able to listen to directions and then go out and have an executive action that was based not on what you want to do, but what you instructed to do, right? Just being coachable. I think martial arts and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu helps so much with that. Just the class structure, the way the kids are. I mean, your kids train, so you've seen it, right?
Like, I love it.
If you have a good instructor that has good personality.
Dante's good with them.
That captivates the kids, right? Like these kids. And they will take that. Like they will take that ability to watch Professor Dante, hear what he's telling them to do, go out and do it. And then the confidence that a child gets from that, right? Like, oh, wait a minute. If I listen and I just do what he's telling me, and then it actually works, and I can make it work on all these other kids in class, like, that's, like, priceless. It's more than the self-defense aspect, for sure.
That's awesome, dude. What is your relationship like with your kids?
So I'm lucky that my kids did another sport that wasn't jiu-jitsu, so that I got to just be
a dad.
Like a dad on the sideline, you know what I mean? Like, I never ran other than just to cut weight to fight, so I know nothing about running. Now I know more because they've been doing it for a while. And it was just me, like, screaming at them, you know. And you know, you only see them once or twice in race. They're just like, choop, choop, choop. So there's not much to say. But I've tried to guide them in the aspect of, you know, listening to their coaches and planning their training, right? And being able to manage their time so that they combine the athletics with the academics. I've had to get them, like, coaches on the side for summer period. Like, they train really hard in the summer, even though they don't have official practices. But, yeah, so it's been fun, man, you know, like just being able to just kind of coach them, but more like a dad, not so much like the running aspect. But
right, you're not their instructor.
Yeah, exactly. Just guiding them and just being more of a dad. So that's been awesome.
What's it been like to be a dad to those kids?
Man, I'm lucky. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like having kids is like you go to Atlantic City and you go like roll the dice and you see what's going to happen. You know, like I feel like through the experiences that I've been able to provide my kids, whether it was spending a summer in Brazil and seeing like a complete different culture, right? Like, or taking them to Europe to see like a place that's been there a lot longer than we have been here in the United States. And even jiu-jitsu and some of the great people that my kids grew, you know, like Frankie Edgar, like my kids grew up, you know, seeing Uncle Frankie, like, and, you know, Uncle Eddie, like Uncle Hanzo, you know what I mean? Like the uncles that I've had, that I've given my kids through jiu-jitsu. Now, all of a sudden, I think it was influential in them making better choices for themselves, you know? Hard choices, like, man, this sport that they do is very hard, and to be a college athlete on a scholarship is very stressful, right? Like, they train at 6 a.m. every Damn. Day, 6 a.m. practice, and then they go to class, right? Like, it's no joke. And I think what's allowed them to do that is to see that from Uncle Frankie, right? Like, it's to see, to have Professor Dante as their instructor that's, you know, like this larger-than-life personality. Right, it's cool. I just got to listen to my coach, and I'll be okay. So, yeah, it's been fun watching them grow up, but I feel like I've been lucky more than I've been a good parent, you know?
What's it like being Ricardo Almeida's kids? The reason I ask that is because, you know, again, you're not in the law enforcement space. You have a correlation to law enforcement. We know that pretty much every MMA, UFC, BJJ guy and girl in the world really appreciates law enforcement and does the best they can to support law enforcement. It's really a true thing. I mean, cops and that's why we have a lot of BJJ and MMA fighters on the podcast, because police and this world, they almost go hand in hand. There's a lot of cops involved, and we have a lot of guys actually who are fighters becoming cops, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
We have a guy out of Vegas. He's in the academy right now. He's going to come on the thing. I don't want to say who it is, but he started following us. Like, who's this guy following? He's got a lot of followers on Instagram. I'm like, oh, it's like a BJJ. He's a big fucking fighter. But well, sometimes we go out and, you know, we have a lot of notoriety now as a big training company in the country. And so we'll be having people recognize me and like, hey, can I get a picture with you? And my kids will always say to me, like, do you know that guy? And I'm like, no, dude, like, you're... And, like, people will say things nice to my kids, like, ah, your dad's a legend, like, you should be real proud of your father. And it's really cool for me then to see that side of it, but I also want to show them, like, how nice I am to everybody, how I go to my way. And knowing that my kids see that, we go to the boardwalk, right, in Point Pleasant. We usually go once a week. Typically when I'm there, I'm usually going to run into 5 to 10 people that I might know, you know, because, again, it's just like you. I mean, not everybody in the world knows who Ricardo Almeida is or Frankie Edgar. You'd have to have some context of the fighting world. But there's a lot of cops in New Jersey. So when I go somewhere, I always try to stop. And if people want to do pictures, whatever it may be. What was it like for your kids? And you guys are clearly on a whole different level than we are. I'm not even comparing myself. But what was it like for your kids having your dad being Ricardo Almeida, a well-known Brazilian jiu-jitsu, MMA, UFC champion?
So I think it's cool, right? Like, I think my kids, you know, they've always been aware that I was a fighter, and, you know, there may be instances like what you're saying, like, we go out and, you know, people that know MMA, they're like, oh, man, hey, Ricardo, like, you used to fight back in the day, man. I used to love watching you fight. So it's cool for my kids to see that, right? But I think the other side of it is, you know, you don't just get to go to the boardwalk and, you know, act like a lunatic, and then you see all these people, and then, like, hey, you know, like, there's a certain expectation of how you're supposed to behave, right? Like, because of all these things that you've done, right? Like, because you are an educator, right? Because you're teaching people, and people expect to be able to have access to you in a certain way. But there's also responsibility that comes with it, right? So I think my kids have understood that, like, very early on, right? Like, that if you're in any position of influencing someone, whether it's little or great, no matter how great it is, right? Because, man, like, yeah, cool, I fought MMA, but, like, I'm not going to Acme and everybody knows who I am.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm not, you know, if Tom Brady goes to Acme, like, that's a problem. Yeah. He's going to shut down Acme, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, like, it's a very different level. But even at the small, minimal level of just being myself, I think it's been pretty cool for the kids, you know. And my daughter is older now, so, you know, boys like her and stuff. And when they find out that I fought, like, they're, like, scared to, you know, come to the house and say hi and things like that. Because I always make hits on, you're going to go out with somebody? All right, they got to come in here and they have to introduce themselves. And then they got to bring you back. Like, you're not just, like, meeting people out in the middle of nowhere, right?
Yeah, yeah,
I
want
to
yeah.
shake their hands. I want to look them in the eye. Because if I have to come after them, they're going to know who's coming.
Could you right? fucking imagine, dude? You meet a girl you like and her father's Ricardo Almeida. What the fuck?
No, thanks.
Yeah, so I want to be able to shake their hands and, you know, put a little bit of fear in the back of their heads a little bit, you know? But, yeah, that's been fun for her, too, because the boy's always like, oh, my God, your dad's so scary. So, yeah.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast, and it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally, and we also entertain you as well.
There's an interesting thing that's been brought up a lot lately in my life, and it's about motivation and discipline, and they're two different things. So maybe you could give us, being you have the experience that you have and you have achieved so much and you've been a champion, I don't even say you are a champion, really you've done a lot more than most people have ever done in their lives and will ever do. What's the difference between motivation and discipline?
I think that they could go hand in hand in a way, right? Like, so I think that discipline starts when motivation ends. In a way.
That's good.
Right? Like, I think, you know, I don't know when this is going to air, but to keep it, like, time irrespective, like, we're at the beginning of the year, right? Like, right now, everyone is super motivated with new goals and new hopes and new aspirations, right? Like, you know, second week of the year, so to speak. You know, where are people going to be in the second month of the year? Like, that feeling is going to be gone, right? So I think that, you know, discipline is what you have, like, when a goal is big enough, right? Like, when you know, I've heard people talk about that, you know, when you need to achieve a certain goal as much as you need to breathe, like, as much as you need air, like, that's when, you know, you're going to have the discipline to do it. Because, yeah, discipline is doing something when you don't feel like doing it, and there is a reason for it, like, motivation, whether that's intrinsical, right? Whether that comes from how you're feeling that day or somebody has to yell at you for you to do it. I believe discipline goes much further than motivation, that's for sure.
What kind of discipline does it take to become a champion?
I mean, all of it. As much as all of the discipline that you could possibly develop, and then it's not even guaranteed, right? Like, a lot of luck goes into being, like, as far as, like, competitive champion. I think all of it and a lot of luck, and in a way in life too, you know. But I feel like in life, you get this momentum wave there. Like, even if things don't go your way and you stay disciplined and you keep working hard, like, that, you know, there's almost this, you know, people talk about the secret, the book, like, but, you know, in a way, you know, sort of like things around you start to conspire to make things happen for you, you know. It's not, oh, I'm going to play the lottery every week. Eventually, I'm going to win the lottery. Like, it's not like that. But I think that if you have a big enough goal and you stay disciplined in the executive actions that are required to get that goal, whether you finally achieve that goal or not is irrespective of the type of person that you're going to become in that pursuit. And that person can do a lot more whether you get to the top of that mountain or not, than the person that was at the bottom of the
never even tried
with just first few steps motivation based. I believe that.
I guess understanding how much discipline it takes to become some of the best or one of the best in the world, I have to imagine you then can take that and translate that into everything else in your life. You understand what kind of effort it takes to have a successful business, have a successful marriage, a relationship with your kids. Does that all tie into the same thing, in your opinion?
I think so. I think that, but I think it's temporary. Like, here's what I mean. Like, I find that when I am more focused on my training, even now that, like, I don't really compete, right? Like, and even if I wanted to compete, there's probably not one MMA promotion out there that would hire me. You know what I mean? I'm too old and slow and so on and so forth, right? I'm not an MMA fighter now because I don't want to. It's because I can't, right? Like, it's past me. But when I'm training hard for somebody like, you know, my age and stuff, I feel like it seeps into other areas of my life. Like, when I'm paying more attention to my training, then, like, I kind of pay attention more of how I talk to my kids, right? Like, and maybe I'm having a better relationship with my wife, and I'm being sharper, maybe looking at, like, you know, KPIs on what's happening with my business, right? Like this level of focus and discipline, I think for sure permeates into every area of your life, right? What it doesn't is expertise, right? Nowadays, you have someone that's, you know, an expert martial artist. And we just had COVID. I had a lot of my fellow martial artists that became, you know, infectious disease specialists, especially on Instagram all of a sudden. You know what I mean? I try to not to talk too much and give advice outside of my expertise and things that I have had the chance to experience personally. Or even observe sometimes, but for sure, I think that the motivation, the discipline, the grit that we get from going after something with every fiber in our being permeates into every area of our life.
Do you feel like that has translated into even an obsession with business? Obviously, when you own a business, right? Clear as day, I'm familiar with this. There is a level of discipline with owning a business. There's a level of... And that discipline is interesting because it's a very, very broad statement. I think that discipline is not just how much time you put in the office being practical and doing things, but it's also how much time you spend educating in business. So how do you translate the things you've done in the fighting world into the business world? How do you educate for business? How do you try to make it better? Are you focused on trying to become the champion of business?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the best way to learn something is to borrow the experience from other people, and whether it's podcasts, right, or whether it's YouTube, whether it's reading books, I think all those things are super important for being a business owner or you know, running a business, or whether it's like business seminars and events and conventions and all those things that sometimes, man, like, oh, I'm going to go to this convention, get on the plane. But yeah, like, you get in there and there's a bunch of people like you that are going through the same struggles as right. you. And next thing you know, you meet one person that's doing one thing slightly different, and that changes your business and that changes your life, right? Like, so I think that being involved and self-educating is really like the skill of the 21st century, in my opinion, right? Like, it's, yeah, cool. Like, you could go get a degree from a university and that's great. And that, you know, it's for sure an achievement in itself. But a lot of these kids come out of university knowing nothing. And if you self-educate, there's just so much information out there. And it's only getting crazier.
Better. Right? Like, just better stuff.
Now people are talking more about AI, like some of the stuff that's happening with like ChatGPT and like some of the stuff. It's just crazy. You know, like, the world's just moving at a very, very fast pace. So we need to continue to educate, you know, from the finances side of the business, through the marketing side of the business, through the people side of the business. Like, those are all things that, you know, are constantly evolving.
This is selfish of me to ask, and I always say this on the podcast because I'm obsessed with business. I love it. This is like my fucking jam, dude. I like it's like cocaine for me.
Yes.
And I don't know. I don't actually think it's the financial success, because obviously, you know that not everything in successful business will return in money. A lot of time, maybe sometimes we start with the idea of making money, but we find that there's better things that come out of it than actual money. And that's typically comes back from what people are getting back from you and your efforts. And that becomes very addicting. And when you can start to have impact and change in a lot of people's lives, it's really, really something. But this is a selfish question for me, which hopefully some of the podcast listeners would also appreciate. But what are some of the books, maybe one or to three books that you thought were really good. You can make them business books or life books if you have listened to books and maybe some of the podcasts you're listening to today.
Mm-hmm. I'll try to remember a couple. And again, like each person is different, but I think the first one is Paulo Coelho, The Alchemist.
Oh, that's a good
book,
yeah.
Like it's very powerful as far as storytelling as well as the more esoteric side of energy and how we kind of feel and interact with the world around us. You know, like I think that one is very, very good. I think Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, right? Like I think that's a...
It changed my life, that book. And you know what changed my life about that book was, I don't know if you recall the subway excerpt when he talks about being in the subway and the kids running around and dragging people and the guy's wife died. You remember that part of the book?
Yes.
That moment, I've been able to apply that 1 4-paragraph page to pretty much everything in life where I've released judgment. And I actually thought about this on the way to my house today. I'm like, man, really, if you just mind your business, you know what I mean? And if you just try to see that, you know, sometimes people try to reach out to me, right? So it's just gotten nuts now. So people are messaging me on Instagram and Facebook. There might be a reason why I'm not able to get back to you. It may not just be that I think I'm better than you or that I'm even just busy, because I'm a human being like everybody else. So I don't want to be judged. Who the fuck am I to judge anybody else? So I think that's a big one for me where I really try before I make any statements or put thoughts about anybody, I try to make sure I don't judge their behavior, whether it's good or bad, their actions, their attitudes. I try to understand why that happened.
Yes.
You know, why is that going on before you? And that book changed my life. Just that one excerpt changed my life. So,
for sure.
But that's two.
And then, you know, now there's more YouTube. So, you know, it's amazing. You have access to like all these people. But I remember back in the day buying the audiobooks from Jim Rohn. I just loved how he speaks. Like it's an English that to me was so clear.
Yeah.
And some of his ideas and some of his storytelling to me were like pretty incredible. You know,
what are some of the worst moments that you've had in your life? Because people probably look at Ricardo Almeida and go, must be great, right? Guy's got it all, right? He's a fucking tough dude. He's a champion. He's got schools all over the place. But people don't realize, like I just said before, that you're a human being like everybody else. You face the same adversities and maybe even more because you're doing such bigger things than most people are doing. So what were some of the worst moments in your life and how did you get through them?
I think two came real quick to my head, and I'll try to be very brief so I can tell you like both of them. I think one was I was in the UFC, and then I decided to go fight in Japan. And at the time, like the pain just wasn't that great. And I was younger, you know, my son was born, and, you know, money was tight pretty much. And I remember one time going to 7-Eleven. We had a 7-Eleven across the street, and I had to buy milk. And man, my card came back declined. And I literally had like no money in the bank not to buy a gallon of milk, right? Like to make like formula for my son at the time. And because I was like in between fights, I can't remember exactly what happened. And I had to go back to my car and like collect all these coins. And to me, it was like personally like one of the most embarrassing to myself moments, more than losing fights, like more than anything of just like collecting all those coins. I ended up getting the gallon of milk. It was no problem. But like at that one very specific moment, like Ricardo, what are you doing? Like you have this like little human being sitting at home waiting and counting on you that he can't fend for himself. Like, what are you doing? You know? And at the time, it influenced my decision to stop fighting and focus on the academy. And later I made, you know, so much more money teaching than I ever made fighting, you know? I never had the life-changing money that a lot of these guys have nowadays. So for sure, it was the best decision I ever did for myself. Learn how to teach jiu-jitsu in a way that it was a business that could sustain my family, you know? And the second one was when my son was diagnosed with autism. You know, I think this is a good one to share because a lot of people will go through this. I remember my son wasn't hitting his developmental milestones. Like, he was barely verbal. Like, he would speak a few words, you know, like no eye contact, you know, some of the flapping and sort of like sensory issues that sometimes we see with kids in the spectrum. I was like, man, something is wrong with this kid. But like, we just have this love for your child, and especially your firstborn child, that you have nothing to compare, that, you know, it took too long for us to go and get my son evaluated. And finally, I had a really dear friend that went, you know, actually to like Columbia University. She had like a connection at Columbia University. We had like all these people, you know, diagnosed my son. And they told me, you know, hey, yeah, your son's autism, you know. And I didn't know what autism meant. Like, I thought that it was basically Rain Man from, you know, from the Tom Cruise movie back in the day. And in a way, it was. Right, like, but I just remember, just like, man, like, what did I do wrong? Like, how did I cause this? Like, having this incredible sense of guilt that I had caused my son to be autistic. And I mean, to this day, there's not 100% explanation of why it happens, you know. But you know, that's what he was then. 5 years old, nonverbal. At ten, he literally had to wear Velcro shoes because he couldn't tie his shoelaces, and sweatpants because he couldn't zip or fly, you know, button like a fly. And now this boy is freaking running track in university, you know, like, so I think that if anybody, you know, watches this, that their kids are in the spectrum, like where your kid is when they first get diagnosed with the right therapy. And especially, I was so lucky that this happened here in New Jersey, which is one of the best states as far as support for kids and families with, you know, little guys in the spectrum. His teachers were life-changing for my son. Like, you know, people, oh, Ricardo, you're a good dad. Like, no, man, my kids, they grew up in good school districts, and that made all the difference in their lives, for sure, their teachers.
How's he doing now?
Like I said, man, he's studying cybersecurity.
Holy
and
shit.
He's really good at computers. He's great with math. He struggled some in his first semester at school. There was an elective that the teacher was like, had a, you know, African accent, and he couldn't really understand what she said, and he takes himself very seriously, and like, he almost failed the class pretty much, and he was like flipping out. Like, he told me, like, Dad, I will go to my dorm and I will cry every day because my grades wasn't good, and I couldn't sleep, so it started affecting my running, and he started getting slower in running. So it was the first hard semester, but he kind of turned the corner like towards the end of the semester. But what he's been able to accomplish as far as, you know, since where he was when he was little, and then, you know, when he got into high school and beyond, it's been incredible.
That's awesome, man. So it's good to tell people that, to give them hope that things will be okay.
Yeah.
What are some of the best memories and moments of your life that you can remember, even if you come up with two right away? What are the best things that you think ever happened?
Man, that's hard. I think your kids is always like something that's very special, you know. I think as a fighter, like one of my fights that I won here in New Jersey, you know, fighting over there in Newark after the fight, we all went to Mark Henry's, the boxing coach for the team. We went to his pizzeria, and he just kind of, you know, turned the ovens on and, you know, grabbed the door in the back. And, you know, we were like maybe 20, 30 of us like in his pizzeria until like 6 o'clock in the morning making pizza after, you know, having just been able to win a fight in Newark. That was pretty special. I think as a coach, for sure, Frankie Edgar winning the title, you know, like, it's, that was like a feat in itself. Like a lot of the Frankie memories are for sure some of my best memories of being like involved in MMA, you know.
Did you know he was special when you saw him?
Yeah, man, you could tell like that he was like special, like right from the get-go. You know, like Frankie walked in, and you know, I sat him in a chair, and I was like, man, so what are your goals? You know, like, because I was older than these guys, you know, so what are your goals? Like, I want to be a champ. And I'm looking at this guy, and back then he used to fight at a much bigger weight class, and I'm like, man, how's this guy gonna, you know, how's this little dude gonna be champion in the UFC, you know? And a couple, you know, a year later he had the belt around his waist. And, you know, for sure, one of the best fighters we've ever seen. So
that's
Frankie
cool.
Is a special person that I have in my heart, like a huge inspiration to me. Not just fighting, but just how he carries himself as a person, as a father, you know, like he's the man.
And he'll be in here in an hour, which is fucking
funny.
Oh,
man, you have a blast. He's the best.
Him and Dante together, this should be interesting.
Yes.
I guess I got to kind of twist this a little bit for law enforcement.
Yes.
Why is BJJ, MMA, this kind of fighting so important for law enforcement? Now, a lot of us now have seen a lot of videos that are surfacing of, and typically there's two different types of videos. One is cops looking like complete jackasses, getting their asses whooped, trying to pull out batons and tasers. And then the other ones we're seeing is trained cops who obviously are in a gym training martial arts in some sense, typically BJJ. I mean, that's really where it's correlating. Why is it so important for law enforcement to be comfortable and have skills like this going into a field where it's typically almost inevitably going to be physical? Why is it so important in your opinion?
We are what we train, right? Like in a way, right? Like we eat, but we are like our behaviors, right? Like, so I think as a cop, if you're training martial arts, and I think very specifically Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu really empowers, if you're in the law enforcement, the ability to control and subdue another human being without striking, like without hitting, and even without choking, right? Because choke is a huge submission in jiu-jitsu, and you know, now you're not supposed to teach chokes, you're not supposed to apply chokes. That's just one of the moves in jiu-jitsu, right? Like you're able to go and pin somebody down without having to pound their face in. But there's a limit to that, right? Like next thing you know, if you're asking some 300-pound guy, 6'6", to get off the vehicle, and this dude comes out, and now you got to pin this guy down. It's like, hey, it's time to get some reinforcements over here, right? Like there's a limit to what you can do. But I think what jiu-jitsu does, and this is how jiu-jitsu revolutionized martial arts, and I think that's why jiu-jitsu was so effective, very specifically in the very first UFCs, right? Where Royce Gracie, like the skinny little dude, comes out and just surprises the world, like, wait a minute, he'll just take you to the ground and he'll submit you, and people didn't even know what was happening, right? Jiu-jitsu, because we train so much and because we make the training so safe, I'm able to grapple you 100% and you're able to grapple me 100%, right? Like, so I'm walking in here, I walk and I see like all these jack dudes and I'm like, man, could you imagine these guys on the floor? Like, I'm already, like, my head is already kind of sizing people up. But if we train, right, and if we train on a consistent basis, I will develop, we develop all the, not only the skills, but the muscle memory, right? But very important, the mindset to be able to deal with a chaotic situation that it is, you know, pretty much being in a fist fight or being in a scuffle where you're having to go try and pin somebody down. And they're trying to hit you. Maybe they're trying to take your gun away. And maybe they have, like, you know, a gun hidden or a knife hidden. Like, I can't even imagine being in a situation like that, right? Like, I think people are a lot harsher on some of these law enforcement encounters than they have the right to say, right? Like, it's tough. It's tough being in a fight. Imagine, like, if someone has a gun hidden and things like that. But I think that with training, I think that there for sure can be a better response from the law enforcement officer, right? Like, I think that being able to practice these moves day in and day out, now next thing you're going out there and you're not hyperventilating, it's like, give me a gun, Ricardo, here's a gun, like, go. What am I going to do then? Am I going to throw it at somebody?
Yeah, I'm going to throw it.
When they're catching it, I'll double leg them, take them down. That'll probably be a better strategy than me trying to shoot them, right? Because I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So with the grappling, it's the same thing, right? Like being able to have this practice day in and day out. And I know that sometimes it's hard for the officers. Like we were talking about this before, right? Like you're going to, you know, attend class in the same town where you're actually like pulling people over and dealing with the, you know, criminal activity, like that stuff, right? Like, so how can we create more training opportunities for the law enforcement body as a whole, where perhaps there's someone that's a really good teacher in jiu-jitsu that's doing it under the supervision or you know, under the cooperation of someone more on the law enforcement side, and these training sessions are happening a lot more often and a lot more consistency than what they're having now. Like, because we need, you know, the training is needed if it's actually going to have the response that's required, right? Like, I think that's where jiu-jitsu can be very powerful that way.
I think it's a good, I just, when you speak, I'm hoping people are listening, because I can't emphasize how important, especially now when people are actually getting trained, right? This is not some uncommon thing. BJJ is very popular. So a lot more people are trained. You know, 20 years ago, I would go out, you get into a bar fight, whatever it may be. Maybe you got a guy who knows how to box. Maybe you got a guy who wrestled in high school. It's a whole different fucking ballgame now. Yep. You got people out there, and a good percentage of people, especially men who are alpha, who are training BJJ, who are out, and they are being social. So when you get involved in a fight, you might think you're a tough guy. But the whole game has changed now. I mean, you got even crazy people who have some experience in training with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and MMA. So, you know, we got to get one step ahead of it. And some of these cops think they're never going to have to use or get into this fight. And I think it comes down to this laziness factor, this non-disciplined lifestyle. But it's a discipline that is so important because what you don't realize is it mainly may end up being your life legally or your life physically.
Yeah.
So these guys just don't want to – I don't know how much more I can emphasize this by other than bringing you, Dante, and Frankie in to like even emphasize how important this shit is.
Yeah, because here's the thing. Like that scuffle, the likelihood of that happening is very, very high.
Yeah.
Right? Like so you have this event that's going to happen in your life if you're a law enforcement that you know it's coming, right? And this dude right here is not ready for it. So you could go and go through that 30-second, 40-second experience. And that's going to be the worst thing that ever happened in your life. Even if you could come out of it okay, you probably did something that you're not supposed to. And next thing you know, maybe you're losing your job that you shouldn't, that you worked so hard to get, right? Or you could every week chomp at the bit and start getting ready for it. And be the dude or dudette or lady that's ready for that scuffle, right? Because you're going to have to pay that price, whether it's a 30-second experience that's going to be the worst, or little by little, we're training, just sort of getting ready and rising to that occasion with a little bit more preparedness. And I think that, you know, if I was in that position, I would probably choose to be ready versus not be ready. Because, you know, the likelihood of that happening, it's about 100%.
Yeah, it's going to happen. I try to tell people, like, it's not a matter of when. It's when. Yeah. What would your position be if you had to put a trained female Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu fighter up against an untrained male, how effective can women be against a man even? And again, we know that men are just naturally built differently than women, right? So I think men are advantageous already off the hop because of genetics. So how do you turn the tables as a female training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? How effective can a woman be at controlling a man?
So I think there's a limit. Right, very specifically in body size and strength, right? Like, but if you take a 135-pound dude versus a 300-pound dude, 6'6", right, that's maybe hopped up on drugs, like, this guy's effectiveness against that big guy is going to be very little, right, in any way, shape, or form, whether it's striking and grappling, or I'm trying to put this person to the ground, right? Now, as far as, like, a girl being able to mess a dude up in grappling, it's, man, we've seen, there's plenty of videos. Like, I have videos of, there's this girl that used to train with me. She was a teenager. She's choking out, like, some Marine, right? Like, in a jiu-jitsu competition, right? Like, there's plenty of videos out there of these girls just messing up dudes that have no idea what they're doing. Now, a lot of times, they're grappling, right? Like, but there is plenty of examples. There was just an example of a Brazilian girl that fights MMA, she might even fight in the UFC, that someone came and tried to rob her, and she just messed this dude up. Like, first she beat the crap out of him standing, then she took this dude down, took his back, put him in a choke, and, you know, this guy is all messed up, and she just waited for the cops to get there to take this guy. So, like, the effectiveness, whether it's a teenager or a woman, like someone that doesn't have the strength versus an adult, is going to be way better than someone that has no training. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, yeah. But you better have it than not. You know what I'm saying?
But it's a game changer for sure. Having someone that's trained.
Multiple people that are trained, right? You got multiple cops showing up. They're
then,
all trained.
Yeah, then for sure.
Yeah, you're going to fuck people up. It's going to be.
Yeah, man. Girls, a lot of times girls, you know, new guys come into the gym and the girls will just mess them all up.
Yeah. That's my last question. You've lived one hell of a life, dude. I'm sure we haven't spent a lot of time going over all the experiences, but I'm just gathering you were here in Europe, in China, and and just living this very different life than everybody else. With all that being said, at this moment in your life, you're in your mid-40s now, right?
Yes.
How do you feel about life?
Man, can I do it all over again? Can I start over? You know, I mean, I feel like I'm just getting started in a way. You know, there's so much more to do. But I feel also like I've come a long way and I'm proud of some of the things that I've done. I also feel like I've made mistakes that if I could go back, I would not make them. And even if sometimes you don't get to go back and say, hey, I'm sorry, like I think that the feeling of feeling sorry is there. But man, I love life. I love the opportunity I've been given. And I try to cherish it by taking care of my body and my mind so they could keep functioning. I enjoy, you know, from training jiu-jitsu through surfing, through just being physically active, but I also enjoy helping people. So I want to be, you know, fit enough so that I could do jiu-jitsu and teach jiu-jitsu at a high level for a long time. So yeah, I'm just getting started. I enjoy it very much.
That's awesome. Why'd you decide to do this podcast today? You took time out of your day.
Man.
You made a decision. It was the free water, wasn't it? That was the pitch.
It was. It was not only this free water, but the biggest water storage that I've ever seen
in
a very long time.
We stay hydrated here.
No, I think, man, I think that, you know, more cops need to train martial arts, right? You know, very specifically, like a grappling-based martial arts. So if I could come in and maybe say, like, one thing that somebody listens and they're like, oh, man, I like that dude, Ricardo. Like, not all the martial arts schools are like Cobra Kai. Like, I think I could do this, right? Like, I think that it helps. So I think I try to think of, you know, certain things that I could do or say that could have a ripple effect. And for sure, with you guys, you know, incredible podcast, like unbelievable setup. Like I think that you have a huge audience, and you know, any little thing said in here makes a huge splash. So why wouldn't I be here?
What I'm hearing is that you actually care about law enforcement, and it's important for you to be somebody for them and try to give them guidance, which is great. Appreciate that.
For sure.
That's awesome, dude. And where can they find you? I think people should follow you on Instagram. You got a good IG.
I mean, man, don't follow me. Follow these guys. They know what they're talking about. I mean,
follow him too.
I'm on Instagram. I'm on Instagram. On Facebook too. I have my schools. One here in Robbinsville, New Jersey. Another one that I just opened in Lakewood Ranch, Florida. We actually have a couple cops. We have a couple Homeland Security guys. You know, very interesting people as always. Kind of become attracted to jiu-jitsu. But yeah, I'm around. I'm on the mats. Like if you look for jiu-jitsu and you could spell Ricardo N. Almeida, you'll find me for sure.
What's the website for all your schools and stuff?
RicardoAlmeida.com.
That's awesome, dude. All right. Appreciate you being here, man. This is great.
Thank you.
You're the man, bro. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.